Digital Radio now, it's time for the daily service led by the Reverend Ernie Ray. Here on FM, it's our Book of the Week, in which James Nestor, the American journalist, investigates the frontiers of deep-sea exploration and freediving, in which swimmers dive without oxygen or scuba gear. Today he plunges down to 2,500 feet in a homemade submarine. The reader is William Hope.
Someday, free diving may help me swim with sperm whales and perhaps plunge way past 40 feet. But it could never take me down to the edge of the bathypelagic zone, a realm of pure and permanent blackness that extends from 3,300 down to 13,000 feet. No sunlight has ever touched these deep waters. Humans can access this world only by using deep water machines. And I want to go there. I want to go deep. Few submarines could make such a journey. My only option would be to board a private submarine. These subs, however, are prohibitively expensive. Then a friend told me about a New Jersey man named Carl Stanley. Carl Stanley began building a submarine out of plumbing parts in his parents' backyard when he was 15. When he was 14, he had spent 6 weeks in a mental hospital, diagnosed with defiance of authority syndrome. 8 years later, he had designed and hand-built a vessel, and he had done it for a total of $20,000. The sub could carry two people down to 725 feet. I decided to find out more about Stanley and his homemade submarine. Because taking tourists down in a homemade, unlicensed submarine without insurance was a liability nightmare, Stanley moved his operation to Roatan, Honduras, where regulations for underwater craft were lax or non-existent. Stanley's submarine tours were a hit. A few years later, he designed and built a bigger vessel named Idabel that could carry three passengers down to about 3,000 feet. I wanted to go as deep as Idabel could take me. The trip down and back, he said, would take about 4 hours. I'd be curled up in a steel ball the size of a car trunk, and I would have to stay there without stretching, peeing, or losing my mind for the entire expedition. He had no disclaimers, no liability waivers for me to sign, no insurance requirements. If something bad happened, all passengers, including Stanley, who piloted every dive, would die. End of story. No submarine left, and nobody to sue. All I had to do was wire him $1,600 and pick a date. So I did. Idabel is double occupancy, meaning that I had to purchase two passenger seats. I invited Stan Kuchai, a dolphin scientist I had met a few months earlier, to come along. He was ecstatic to be joining me. But after Kuchai viewed Idabel's cramped conditions, the sub is 13 feet long and about 6 feet wide, his excitement turned to a sort of silent dread. It was time to board. Kuchai volunteers to hop in first. I watch as he squeezes his long torso through a 2-foot-wide hole at the top. He gives a thumbs up through the front window and shakes his head, laughing. "I don't think you're going to fit in here." I prove him wrong, managing to wiggle in next to him. I'm sitting not so much beside Kuchai as on top of him. Idabel's electric motors rumble into life. We gaze out the window at two very different worlds, brassy sunshine above and silvery water below. Under direct sunlight, the temperature inside Idabel has reached 98 degrees. We take off our shoes to cool our sweating feet. "Here we go," Stanley announces. We begin the descent. At the top of the window toward the surface, bands of blue stretch out on the horizon and grow darker and darker, like a Rothko painting, but less defined. We glide down gracefully to the ocean floor like a hot air balloon in reverse. The depth gauge reads minus 300 feet. Stanley still hasn't turned on any interior lights, and our clothes, skin, notepads, and the world outside all appear to be the same bluish color. A few minutes later, we pass 800 feet. At this depth, no plants can survive, and from here on down, the entire ocean is animal and mineral. Ida Bell's frame begins to fizz and creak under the pressure, which has reached more than 350 pounds per square inch. Kuchai is hunched over on his knees and looks like he's going to be sick. Then I'm hit by a wave of nausea and paranoia. We've been confined in this steel pod for only about 30 minutes. We've got 3.5 more hours to go before we'll see sunlight or a bathroom. Suddenly, there's a bright flash on one side of the sub, then another. Stanley has just snapped on Ida Bell's headlights. The water in front of us glows as white as milk. Then, as our eyes adjust, it softens to green-gray, the color of an old television screen. Outside the window, thousands of white flakes stream past us. Stanley tells us this is detritus from the sunlit waters above. Phytoplankton skeletons, fish feces, sloughed-off skin, whatever. It all eventually ends up falling to the sea floor in an endless swirl. Stanley unexpectedly shuts off the lights. "Keep looking out the window," he says. "It's black out there. We've just pushed down past 1,700 feet, the zone where no sunlight can reach." "You see it?" Stanley says. "It looks like fireworks exploding in the night sky. The colors are brilliant, white with flashes of pink and purple and green. We're looking at what ancient mariners referred to as the burning sea, bioluminescence, the chemical production of light by living organisms." Stanley flips the lights back on, and the black water in front of us instantly turns gray with the perpetual snowfall of detritus. The fireworks disappear. This world is utterly featureless. There are no mountains here, no skies, no landmarks, nothing to distinguish right from left, up from down. Night never becomes day. There are no seasons. The temperature is always the same. There is no specific home for the animals that live here, just constant drifting. I feel a profound existential sadness here. It is the blackest, loneliest place I've ever seen. Ida Bell passes 2,000 feet. The hull's fizzes and squeaks grow louder and more frequent. The pressure outside is now more than 900 pounds per square inch. If a pinhole leak suddenly appeared in a wall, the water would cut through flesh like a scalpel. Death at this depth wouldn't happen slowly. I realize that if we all die down here, nobody will know what happened, not even us. Oddly enough, I feel almost serene. Absolutely nothing is in my control. A pale light appears before us, and it seems like we're approaching some distant moon. We ready ourselves for a landing. Ida Bell squeaks and fizzes. We've just touched down at 2,500 feet. The view outside is lunar. Boulders, shallow craters, and broad, open plains, all glowing as white as if the place had just been dusted with snow. That powdery blanket is the leftover calcium and silicon from billions of microscopic skeletons, a fine substance that biologists call ooze. Because there is no sun to melt it, no wind to blow it, no rain to wash it away, the ooze just stays here, building up about an inch every 2,000 years. We've just landed on the Earth's oldest graveyard. It seems impossible that anything could survive down here. And yet, all around us there is life, of a variety that's more strange and ugly than I could have imagined. Moving across the white expanse is a reddish, eel-like fish about 2 feet long. It waddles by on two stumpy legs. Farther away, a fish the size of a lapdog squats near a rock. Its skin is covered in brown blotches that look like tree bark. Every few seconds, it opens its mouth like an old man yawning. Everything down here seems half-developed, awkward, slow-moving, and crippled in some way, like failed experiments from God's test kitchen. But this assumption couldn't be more wrong. In a world without light, looks don't matter. What does matter is efficiency and adaptability. And each of these animals, as awkward and ghastly as it might appear, has evolved to fit into its own tiny niche. Stanley revs the motor.
"Hey, take a look at this," he says as he cranks Idabel to the left.
He stops the sub. A 2-foot glob of flashing color approaches. Along the top of this glob is a blanket of lights, all blinking, one after the other, in perfect synchronicity. First, only blue lights flash, then only red, then purple, then yellow, until every color in the spectrum has flashed. The hundreds of rows of little lights are evenly spaced around the glob. It looks like a cityscape at night. Between these lights, there is nothing. No visible flesh, no nerves, no bones or body. "What the hell?" Kuchai says, his eyes and mouth open wide. Stanley says it's a comb jellyfish. It has no eyes, no ears, no digestive system, no muscles. It has no brain, and yet this animal hunts prey its own size. It mates and can move nimbly through the water. And there it is, this thing 2 feet from our faces, watching us with its non-eyes, communicating with its non-brain, and dazzling us with its Las Vegas lights. As I'm sitting in this cramped metal sphere, I feel an emptiness in my chest that breath can't fill. This is the real Earth, the silent majority. And this is how it looks. Gelatinous, cross-eyed, clumsy, glowing, flickering, and cloaked in perpetual darkness. The azure sphere we see from space is only a veneer. It's not filled with leaves or grass, clouds, color, and light. Our planet isn't really blue. It's black.
William Hope was reading Deep by James Nestor. It was abridged and produced by Pippa Vaughan and is a Loftus production for BBC Radio 4. Tomorrow in the final episode, James is in Sri Lanka, challenging himself to conquer the life-preserving reflex known as the master switch of life. In a couple of minutes in Woman's Hour, we'll hear from the 80-year-old stand-up comedian Lynn Ruth Miller.
It just got totally still, totally quiet.
Oklahoma is in the heart of Tornado Alley.
And then all of a sudden, it just wham, it hit our place.
BBC Radio 4 finds out what happens when a twisting funnel drops from the sky.
The tornado went from 30 miles an hour to nearly 60 miles per hour in just over a minute.
And it sounded like metal being shoved through a shredder.
The hail was so big, when it would hit the cellar, it sounded like a gunshot.
At the same time, it went from a mile wide to 3 miles wide. It just gobbled people up.
Crossing Continents in Oklahoma, this morning at 11.